Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in public health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
It's the Media Project, your chance for some commentary, analysis, and perhaps even a little bit of insight into the media issues of the week. And you can hear that I'm not Rex Smith.
I was just going to mention that.
Rex, what happened?
I am not Rex Smith. I'm Mike Spain, the associate editor at the Times Union, filling in for Rex Smith, my boss. Today, joining me is political scientist, publisher, professor, professor emeritus, CEO of WAMC Public Radio, etc., 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 Dr. Alan Chartog. Welcome, Dr. Chartog.
And welcome to you, Michael. Always great to see you here. You are a magnificent human being. Everybody loves you. I've never met anybody who doesn't love Mike, period.
Well, let's not get started. We're also here with the editor of the Poughkeepsie Journal, that's Stuart Chinsky.
Welcome, hi, guys.
Stu.
Yeah, great to see you, Mike.
Thanks for making the trip up the Hudson Valley today.
A little fog, but a nice drive.
Oh, that's great. Let's jump right into it. Today, we want to talk about how the New York Times sandbagged Bernie Sanders. The New York Times has taken a lot of heat from supporters of Bernie Sanders who say the old gray lady is not covering him enough, and some say the newspaper has had a generally sarcastic approach to his run for the presidency. Maybe this could also be about how in the digital age, editing happens real time, and stories are sometimes posted, and then they get edited, and they're reposted and reposted as the day rolls on. Matt Tabby, a writer for Rolling Stone, is accusing the New York Times of first publishing a piece online that was quite favorable about how Bernie Sanders, as a congressman, would work amendments and get his agenda pushed through Congress. But later in the same day, a revised version of the piece by the Times veteran reporter Jennifer Steinhauer was reposted with a new headline and some significant editing that toned down some of the parts of the earlier story, making it less favorable to the senator from Vermont. And, you know, it goes on to explain what some of those changes were, including the headline. It toned down what they called victories and later called them accomplishments and got some of his agenda through. Do we think that the New York Times, first of all, has a bias against Bernie Sanders?
I think, this being Alan for the moment, I think that the New York Times has a bias against everybody who's running this time. I don't think they like Bernie because he's outside of their worldview, or Weltanschauung, a word I use every once in a while around here. You know, their worldview is Franklin Roosevelt, middle range. I think that, you know, I have to subscribe to it. Everybody should have health care, everybody should have a house, but we want to preserve a capitalist democracy. That's their worldview. Bernie Sanders is a little farther to the left for them, I think, and I think that that makes them uncomfortable. Hillary Clinton, you know, who they're going to eventually endorse, of course, is also problematic for them because they don't like, and they seem to indicate they don't like her character one way or the other. I mean, with some of her stuff that she gets into, and they're not afraid to criticize her. Maybe character's too strong for me. And then, you know, the Republicans go without saying. I've never seen anything like what the New York Times has been doing to Trump editorial in any other way. Mm-hmm. So I don't think, like a lot of other Americans, including me, they have a candidate they really can feel passionately for, so they take a critical view. But the fact, as you're reading this, Mike, that they have taken an established story and modified it, maybe because of some kind of pressure, either editorially from within or from without, that's something.
That's what I took from it. I took from this saying, wait a second, and I went back and I looked at the stories. Mm-hmm. This just strikes me as poor editing at the New York Times.
The first time or the second time?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Frankly, the first time. Right. Or maybe the second time, too, because this wasn't like a breaking news story where there's a building on fire and you got to get it on the web in 30 seconds. This is an analytical think piece. The writer writes it, and then a few hours later, or later in the day, it's substantially, almost incredibly different.
Well, isn't there
what happened to the original editing process?
Hey, Stewie, isn't there somebody in the slot who's supposed to look at that stuff before
well,
it goes
clearly,
out?
Exactly.
Without knowing all the facts, it seems somebody complained about it after it was posted online. And this fellow from Rolling Stone reached out to Jennifer Steinhauer and asked her about it. And she said, well, this kind of thing happens in the internet age where you post and you revise right before the general public. It is kind of awkward to have your work changed.
Well,
that doesn't happen like that. It shouldn't happen on a piece like this where, you know, breaking news, yes, but not on an analysis, sort of a thumbsucker, they're called in the industry, where this was not, you know, timed to a get it on the website by X p.m. Do it right the first. This is the New York Times. They have, what, 1,300 people in their newsroom when they can't do a story right the first time where it has to be changed dramatically?
You just said something which I wanted to ask you about. Why is it called a thumbsucker?
Because I think the image is that your thumb is in your mouth in 1947, I guess, when it was, where you sort of say, this is very interesting. It's
right.
Very
you
appealing.
Sit back and read it. An analysis is usually not a short piece and not a breaking news story, as you described, but it's something that was thoughtful and put together and bounced around and people look at it and there was vetting and copy editing, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, just to make it clear, it wasn't a thumbsucker. Your thumb was below your lip. If your thumb was in your mouth, it would have been a whole different thing.
I think it's time to move along.
We defer to the PhD.
No, but I want to say one more thing about this, and that is that I have said it for years, that lobbyists are lobbyists. They don't have to have the term lobbyist before their name. Somebody on each team reads the press and makes a call and says, that wasn't fair, that wasn't right.
In this case, it appears that whoever reached the right editor at the New York Times made an impression, and they reposted it, toning down some of the assertions they first made about Bernie Sanders and his success in Congress. So it's very interesting to see the kind of influence without knowing who had that influence and how exactly it happened.
And
which calls into question the quality of the editing in the first place, because if the New York Times says something is fit to publish, it should be able to be stood behind by its editors and writer.
Well, there you have it. Well, Alan, this is one about NPR, one of your favorite places
good,
to talk
good,
about.
Good.
And it has to do with Cokie Roberts, whose name is synonymous with NPR. She was one of the early reporters for years. And now she does a commentary every Monday morning on Morning Edition. And
I think she may do it from her house. I think she may have one of those.
That may
things.
Well be.
I always have this image of her in a bathrobe sitting at the kitchen table doing this. But maybe I'm wrong.
Reading a thumbsucker.
Yes. Right. Well, she and her husband, journalist Steve Roberts, co-authored a column for a weekly newspaper where they urged the rational wing of the Republican Party to stop Donald Trump. And that was a few weeks ago. Well, this week on Morning Edition, the commentator and host David Green was talking to Cokie Roberts about that column and then stopped to talk about how he was perhaps disappointed, and some people would be disappointed that they regard her as an objective journalist, that she would take a position like that. She pointed out, of course, that she hasn't been on the payroll of NPR since 1992 and that she comes on as a commentator and she has that license. What is that line? Where, if you're a journalist, can you cross it and become a prognosticator, a pundit, and a commentator? And what do all those words mean?
Well, it's a little iffy in this case. But the truth of the matter is that all three of us who are sitting here have invited many commentators to either write for our newspapers or to. We have a lot of commentators here at WAMC, right-wingers, left-wingers, middle-wingers, her-wingers. And each of those people come on and they give their opinion. We say after every one of them, you know, this is the comment of the commentator and not necessarily that of the radio station. And I think it's terrific. However, the problem here is that, as you said before, Mike, she's synonymous with NPR. Something must have happened for them to go out of their way, Mike and Stu, for the way that they did to sort of get into what's the difference between a commentator and an analyst and all like that.
Yeah, they put out this clarification saying, oh, she's a commentator. But I was wondering, as I delved into this situation, do readers care? You know, do they really care?
Or
they,
somebody like, obviously cares.
Well, there's Cokey, and she's giving her thoughts.
Or Cokey.
But do readers care if it's a commentator versus a columnist or a pundit?
Well,
do readers really care?
Interesting. Do people
because
really
she doesn't really
notice
do reporting,
the difference,
per se.
Right. She's bringing facts. She's analyzing them. She's putting them in perspective, and she's expressing a point of view. I mean, really, when a reporter is to write a story, it's to gather information and try to present it in a coherent way, trying to be objective. You can never be truly objective. We could talk about that for hours. But when you're a commentator, you begin to cross the line into giving your opinion like a columnist.
Right.
And some people have no problem with that at all. Others seem really offended by it. One of our Metro columnists, Chris Churchill, appears on the Times Union's Capital Region section.
And appears here every once in a while.
That's right. He's a frequent guest here at WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, which is the originator of this program. And someone called the other day and was all upset that his column, which took a political position for a local issue, was not on the editorial page. And she basically just said it should be on the editorial page, period. And I explained it has his logo. He's a licensed columnist. He's not a reporter. He gets to have his opinion. And she just simply disagreed. She was a very articulate person. So it is a point of view that different people have.
Well, it is. And, you know, there's a whole group of people who are very frustrated by what's going on in this election. So I have made the decision that I was going to talk about who I voted for so that people would know where I came from. This has drawn a certain amount of disdain from my contemporary journalists, but I think every journalist ought to say who they're going to vote for, because I think it's a better way to do it. However, your paper, which I love, Mike, I love the Albany Times Union. I just die to read it. But there is a decision you made years ago that I think is really wrong. You have taken Trudeau, Doonesbury, right, off the comic
page. Off the comics page.
And put it on the editorial page, right, or in a different place.
That's correct, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there you see the opposite of what you're talking about now. You say, well, okay, this content is really political and editorial, and so we're going to move it to a different place. Don't you see?
Yes, but when you own the printing press, you can pretty much do what you want.
Well, yes. We call this arrogance. And I think your caller may have been frustrated. I know the Bernieites. I had a call the other day from somebody who said that I was electioneering for someone. And I called the person back because I like this person. Good guy. And I said, what do you mean? Who was I electioneering for? He said, well, it seems to me you may be electioneering for Bernie. In the meantime, I'm getting tons of mail saying, yeah, you said you're going to vote for Bernie, but you're always sort of saying nice things about Hillary. You know, how dare you? You're really a Hillaryite as opposed to a Bernieite. And they get very, very angry at me.
Well, do you regard that as affirmation that you're being even-handed in the way that you talk?
No, I just regard it as mean-spirited.
Well, I'd like to say you're listening to the Media Project coming to you today with Alan Chartok, Stu Shinsky, and Mike Spain.
Let's just make it clear, you're Mike.
Yes, I am indeed.
He's Stu.
I'm Stu.
Yeah.
And who does that leave you being, Alan Chartok? Okay. How do you think Donald Trump treats reporters? There's a lot of reporting going on and a lot of commentating going on about the way that he has taken off at reporters. He's accused the media of
being biased,
and he seems to be getting a lot of cheers from the audience when he does so. Stu, how do you think?
He's doing what Trump does best, which is he taps into a zeitgeist, moment, and he jumps all over it. You know, people hate the media, that big fat glob known as the media, even though we're all little different pockets within that world. So he says that reporters are disgusting and people cheer him, and that's his magnetism on display. And I think for him, you know what, he probably does hate some reporters, but he's also had, over the years before this race, a lot of glowing profiles printed about him. So I think he's just tapping into the audience.
So let's zero in on Megyn Kelly for a moment.
Yes.
Beautiful woman, although it is irrelevant. I'm saying this as a feminist, irrelevant that she's beautiful. I'm just saying that he knew what he was doing because he wanted attention. He always wants attention.
Mm-hmm.
And when he picked this fight with her and is now continuing that fight, even though it looked like it had gone away for a while, he is also tapping into our penchant in this society for attention to things sexual. Now, that may seem like a little bit, off to you guys, but I think he knows what he's doing. So, you know, he made off-color remarks about his daughter. You know, if I wasn't her father, you know, I think he said something like, I don't want to go out with her.
That's a little bit icky.
Yeah,
it may be icky to you.
Yeah, that's Greek mythology, isn't it? The Oedipus stuff.
Yeah, there's something going on there.
It may be
Freud would have a ball with it, too.
Well, Freud would be right.
But he's tapping in.
Yes.
And I think also his the Megyn Kelly history there also taps into his animosity with Fox News on a larger scale. So I think it's multifaceted.
You mean you think that, we were talking about the Times before, do you think that Fox News has a horse in the race?
I think that Fox News and Trump, I thought they'd be more closely aligned, and I think that maybe Fox News doesn't like that Trump is his own guy, does what he wants, says what he wants, and doesn't really care about the convention of what he's supposed to do under the Republican banner.
It's interesting, Stu, because I haven't figured it out yet. I don't have any idea. I believe, personally, that Trump is their best bet in order to win the presidency, because he brings over the middle.
Yes.
And you can't win a presidential election, especially the Republicans, now if you don't have the middle in America.
Right, you got to swing.
So he brings it over. But they are death against Trump, the Republican establishment. Now, Mitt Romney gets up there, gives a big speech, and it looked clearly to me like Mitt Romney is saying, okay, boys, I'm available.
Yeah, draft me if you want. Yeah, I can play that point guard position and be president.
Yeah, I'm available.
Yeah.
When you're talking about Fox News, how about the Breitbart website, Breitbart News, which is an extremely right-wing website. It's described.
Is it Breitbart or Breitbart?
Breitbart. I'm sorry.
Breitbart, yes, I believe.
No, sorry. Yeah.
No, appropriate correction there. Breitbart is a news and opinion website. It's kind of tabloid, shoot from the hip mentality. It was founded by the late Andrew Breitbart, who died back in 2012, and it has been strongly supporting the rise of Donald Trump as the outsider candidate who's going to come in and disrupt the way things are with the establishment. And now it's having internal problems because one of its own staffers, Michelle Fields, a reporter, claims that she was roughed up by one of Trump's campaign people, his campaign manager, actually, Corey Lewandowski. She said he grabbed her and shoved her at a Florida rally last week. At first, Breitbart was supporting her, but then later put out statements that kind of questioned whether she was accurate. She's resigned from Breitbart, so have a couple of other employees. And it seems like even in the right, in the media, in the very right-wing media, if there is such a thing, there's upheaval. And Donald Trump seems to be at the center of all of this. He seems to be disrupting not only government and the political process, but the media, too.
Well, you know, I've been thinking a lot about Donald Trump. And when we were in Italy a number of years ago, and I was talking to some people in a railroad car, and we could hardly communicate. But I mentioned that Berlusconi, then the prime minister, wanted to build a bridge from Sicily over to the mainland.
That's quite a long way.
You bet. And they laughed. Old ladies, others, there was a sort of similarity to what we're seeing here now. What is this guy going to do next? What is he going to say next? What is he going to do next? And I think people who are not fully up to date on what goes on in American politics are likely to be attracted to this kind of thing. When he got up there and said, we love the uneducated. We love the uneducated. Well, I think he was telling you the truth.
Well, according to demographic studies and polls, that Donald Trump has strong support from people who have less than a college education. And I don't know exactly what that translates into, but that may be one of the reasons he loves them.
Well, you know, as a lifelong college professor, I can say this to you. I've known a lot of people who didn't go to college. And the School of Hard Knocks is a great educator. And by the time, you know, it's later on in life, they have a pretty good idea of what my father read 6 newspapers a day and he didn't go to college. Mm-hmm. In fact, he had to get a GED degree but he was smart. I mean, really smart. So this business about you didn't go to college, it rubs me the wrong way.
There's a snobbery to it, I think.
You know, I was wondering with the Breitbart case, what struck me about this was that it all happened so quickly.
Right.
You know, there was this incident, and the reporter said she was jostled and maybe even physically assaulted, to use a legal word, by this Trump staffer. And then it was basically done a few days later. If this were an employee where I work at the Poughkeepsie Journal in New York, there'd be a full-fledged investigation here. We would have corporate counsel involved. We would be talking to the police. We'd be doing multiple interviews. There's no way this would be settled in a couple of days.
Yeah.
And I can understand. I think I can understand from the little that I know from the outside why she resigned so quickly. That she got no support from her employer,
Well, maybe
like.
Yes and maybe no. I got to tell you.
There's always...
people.
Or maybe she might have a checkered history and there was other incidents in the...
Well, Stewie, we here in Albany, we had the case, which made national headlines, of three African-American women claiming that they had been harassed on the bus. Well, it turns out they had all kinds of cameras on the bus and everything. And according to reputable sources, it never happened. In the meantime, everybody from the President of the United States on down had jumped on the bandwagon.
Right.
So sometimes there is another side to these things.
Very true.
Absolutely. Well, I should point out that as we are discussing media issues, we are in the midst of what is known as Sunshine Week. It's the annual recognition by news organizations to highlight the importance of open government.
Nothing to do with the weather.
And access to public records and to herald the First Amendment. And there's an interesting piece this week by Anders Gyllenhaal from the Poynter Institute, which studies media issues. And he raises the provocative question, will the First Amendment be able to survive in the information age? And what he's talking about is, up till now, those 45 words in the Constitution that make up the First Amendment that have survived so far for 200 and somewhat years may not cover all the issues that are now coming up with Google searches and Facebook posts and companies that want to take over the internet and corporations that want to have their own First Amendment rights. Do you think the First Amendment is in peril and perhaps it needs to have another clarification?
Well, let's do a little history. The First Amendment went into effect in, 1776-ish?
Early 80s, I think.
Something like that. So before 1800, historians do all the fact-checking on it. So it's been around 200 and something years, and it's seen the dawn of radio, the dawn of television, the dawn of everything,
motion
technologically,
pictures,
motion pictures,
telephone.
And the First Amendment, as far as I know, is still there and still sort of working. So I think it'll survive the world of Twitter. I think it'll survive the world of social media, and it'll bend, it'll change.
Well, Stu.
But the principle, I think, will survive.
Well, the principle is there, but we see guys coming out and releasing all kinds of documentation about how the American government may have been not truthful, let's put it that way, with people, and we go after them and we want to put them in jail. And as you know, from the very beginning, there have been court cases about this. In fact, there are limits on the First Amendment. You can't yell fire in a crowded theater. And so there have always been a sort of a tension, about this.
Tests of the First Amendment.
And now you have Daniel Ellsberg comes along and he says, I'm going to give you, release this stuff. And there's a question as to whether or not...
Prior restraint, whether a court can stop the New York Times from publishing something.
Yeah.
And in that case, the Supreme Court backed the New York Times. And we learned about the abuses and the misinformation the government was putting out about the Vietnam War. So it has sustained an awful lot of assaults on it, but now corporations want rights under the First Amendment, and what does that mean exactly? They want to have rights to withhold or say whatever they want on their labeling and products. It's getting very confusing, and maybe that's what the next Supreme Court will have to look at whenever that is resolved.
And by the way, just while we have a moment on that, as we speak, just the other day, the president nominated what looks to me like a superb and competent justice who was confirmed himself at the
appellate court level.
And I was watching CNA and all of the experts were saying things like, this will never happen. The Republicans aren't going to let it happen. Well, we know Mitch McConnell said he wouldn't let it happen. We know they have a fairly big group of people who said, no, we're all in, Republicans, we're all in on this together, several of whom have to defend their seats. And the American people, by overwhelming numbers, think this is just wrong, that they're not gonna consider the person who the president has put up. Well, if that is the case, some of those senators are going to lose, and they could lose the Senate, in which case, if they see that coming, believe me, they're going to be people who jump off the ship.
Well, that could mean that if a Democrat is elected president and these Republican senators lose their seats, it could be a very liberal court going forward over the next 4 years.
Which is why they're being stupid.
Right. And that could bode well for the First Amendment, do you think?
But you also said something else that I thought was interesting, and that is, let's say the election happens and they see that the president is going to be Hillary Clinton, let's just say. and they say, well, Hillary's going to get three appointments. Yeah. That's when they're going to confirm that
they're
guy.
They're going to rush in and give Justice Garland the confirmation, because they just might get, if Hillary is president, they might get someone far more liberal than they ever wanted.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time.
No, don't
say
that.
For Alan Chartok and Stu Shinsky, I'm Mike Spain, and thanks for joining us this week.
Should be an hour.
On the Media Project.
Mike, thanks to you for joining us.
Yeah, you were very good today. Very good. You kept us right where we should be.
Thank you.
Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.